So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center's Pinwheel Education Series on Journey Through Recovery, Overcoming Setbacks. The Pinwheel Education Series is a monthly forum that brings together experts and persons with lived experience to talk about mental health and mental wellness. Everything related to the Pinwheel Series, including a recording of today's session, can be found at www.keltymentalhealth.ca/pinwheel. So we really appreciate your feedback. So for those of you that are in the room, if you can fill out the feedback form that's on the table in front of you, or those of you via telehealth will have sent that to you. So for those of you that are joining us for the first time, the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center is a provincial mental health and substance use information and resource center serving BC children, youth, and families. We also offer peer support to families and youth, as well as to people of all ages struggling with eating disorders. You can visit our website at www.keltymentalhealth.ca for more information, resources, and for our contact information. Okay, so let's just dive right in. Our first speaker is Dr. Kara Ansari. She's a child and adolescent psychiatrist. She's currently the medical director for the Provincial Youth Concurrent Disorders Program located at BC Children's Hospital, and is a consultant in multiple youth clinics, including the Langley Child and Youth Mental Health Team in the Frasers. Dr. Ansari is also the current president of the BC Psychiatric Association. So welcome, Dr. Ansari, and go ahead.
Well, I wasn't sure that this was a lecture or whether this was a discussion, so I didn't come here prepared to have a lecture at this point. So I can say we're talking about the journey through recovery, and I think it's important to, when we look at through recovery, what is driving substance use? So we know that there's a lot of different things that drive substance use, and there are things that we have to look at and target from a lot of different perspectives. So we work in the concurrent disorders program, and so when we've done some review of why people use, I looked at a review a couple of years ago, and it was where they just picked out like 20 people and they actually just sat and interviewed them, and that was the study, and said, why are you using substances? And it kind of broke down into two areas. One was about recreational use. So these are just the kids who go out and enjoy going out with their friends, and it's very peer-based, and it's very much party kind of thing. But then there are some they were using for coping. And they talked about, I don't know what else to do to manage the symptoms I'm having. I see my friends and they're using this, or they're recommending that I use these substances because they help, or it's being modeled to me by family or friends. So it kind of broke down into those two areas. And the great thing is the McCreary Center Society, which does an adolescent health survey every 5 years, in their most recent survey asked youth why they were using. And when you look at the reasons, they kind of break down in those two areas as well. So the majority were still saying, I use it for fun, recreation, I'm out with my friends, and that just kind of, I do it and that's kind of the end of it. But there was a good proportion of it, and I think, there's many different categories, but I think even some around 30% were saying, I use this because I feel sad, or I feel anxious, or I don't know how to deal with some of the things I'm coping with in my day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how the idea of concurrent disorders came about, saying we can't just look at substance use in isolation. Now, for some it is, there are some youth that we see that start using a substance and they become addicted to the substance, and it's really around that. They lose control over it, and some of the consequences of that can look like mental health, but they're not necessarily driving the substance use. But then we also know that there's the majority of kids who are using substance to the point where they're having a use disorder or an addiction, that mental health does start to come into play, whether it was predisposing, whether it came about because of, or whether those two things just happen independently of one another, but we're seeing two things at the same time. So that's where we get involved and try and understand that, and it's a pretty involved process trying to understand that. There's a lot of factors that go into trying to engage with a youth who sometimes are interested in being a part of that, and sometimes they're not, and sometimes it's families that are driving it, or a school counselor, or sometimes the justice system. So it can take some time, and what our psychiatric nurse is here with me today, and so she's been, and we've been working together for many years, and we kind of know that this is really about meeting this youth and kind of engaging with them where they're at and trying to work with them and get to where they want to go. And that's not always the same place everybody else wants them to go when we first meet them. Sometimes they get to the same place, but not always. And those are things that can affect their recovery. So I'm not sure if there's more that I can add in right now, or we'll get back to me later.
Sure. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the program as well?
Sure. So the Provincial Youth Concurrent Disorders Program has been in existence for about 10 years. And it's an outpatient program. We don't have any inpatient beds. We're not a residential treatment program. We are primarily fall under mental health. And we're a multidisciplinary program, which means we have a psychiatric nurse, we have a clinical counselor, we have a social worker, we have psychologists, and we have psychiatry. And we all work together to try and understand the youth. We do assessment and we do treatment. We also do knowledge exchange kind of activities. We go out and teach about concurrent disorders. We train upcoming residents and medical students in concurrent disorders. Mm-hmm. And we see youth between the ages of 12 to 25, which is different than a lot of other places. Mm-hmm. That separates kind of what is a child, what is a youth, and what is a young adult. So we bridge that transitional age gap, which is kind of unique. Mm-hmm. I think, what else?
I just want to add in that we have done research.
Yes,
and true. That right now we're almost at the point where the paper is going to be shared.
Yeah, will it be submitted for publication?
Yeah, so that's really exciting. So briefly, what we know is that a lot of our youth have trauma backgrounds, and a large percentage met criteria for PTSD.
Mm-hmm. And post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, and so that has informed our treatment. We are doing Seeking Safety, which is a structured, manualized treatment by Lisa Nojavitz, and it's for PTSD and addiction. Yeah. So it's an evidence-based treatment.
Yeah. So we did two major studies. One is just trying to find out what are the psychosocial determinants of youth who are using substances and who show up at our clinic. So, and one of the things that came up was about trauma. Another study we did was looking at kind of attitudes towards smoking cessation when you're a youth. You know, we have this thinking that, or at least we came into it thinking that if a youth was smoking cigarettes and we offered them treatment, they'd want to do it. And then we realized maybe that's not true. Maybe we need to be thinking of youth and their cigarette use is different than adults and their cigarette use. And we are finding some of the preliminary data is showing that a lot of youth use cigarettes as a means of, again, dealing with emotions and in dealing with anxiety. And if we're not kind of targeting those areas, then we won't be very successful in helping a youth stop smoking. So that's all the things that we've been kind of involved with.
That's great.
Yeah.
Thanks. And we can get into that a little bit more later when we kind of have questions and discussion. So our next speaker is here with us today. Andrea Vauda is a substance misuse counselor for a youth day treatment program at Wetari. She's a former teacher and guidance counselor and registered master practitioner in counseling psychology, and she specializes in adolescent development. So welcome, Andrea.
Thanks. So I'm working at the Wetari Day Treatment Program, which is also an outpatient program. And we've had lots of collaborations with Dr. Sari and some of her patients. And John, too. Let me think. I've been there for 7 years. We're working with a similar demographic, 13 to 24-year-olds. And we're doing a 7-week program. It's for 4 days a week, so equivalent to a 28-day program. It's oftentimes the first point of contact for young people that have substance misuse challenges. And again, same demographic in terms of these kids are coming from either BSYCC, so probation mandated, or guidance counselors have encouraged them, or family has encouraged them. We do take soft referrals, so we do get a lot of young people that are really wanting to take a look at their substance use. But they may fall anywhere on the spectrum between pre-contemplative, so not really, they're partying, they're still in their minds recreationally using substance, and they're not identifying that there are in fact any challenges with their use. And then we have probably about 50% of the kids coming to us are contemplative. So they're recognizing, or they've been encouraged to recognize how substance is impacting things. So school, obviously, legal challenges, housing are sort of the basic ones. So they will come to us, and our format is, we're probably the most low-barriered program for that demographic. They have to have stable housing, but beyond that, so they have to have somewhere safe to go back to, but that could be a shelter environment. A lot of Covenant House youth will come and work with us. And we get started kind of on the softer approach of, it's a general survey of what might therapy look like, but we don't ever call it that. We work from a harm reduction strategy, but we of course embrace abstinence as well as a mode for healthy living. But we work with the young people where they're at and get them kind of engaged in a variety of different alternative therapies. So we will offer things like acupuncture. We'll do like yoga. We'll do grounding exercises, meditation. We also do a lot of narrative therapy. Do a lot of engaging in group discussions, so psychoeducation, and then my favorite, we do a lot of creative expression, which is sort of a lighter form of art therapy, and it tends to be, as an introductory, a really effective way of working with this particular demographic, just because it, what we do know about recovery, or moving into that the journey of recovery, as this pinwheel's been coined, is that once we've recognized that the substance is a factor, and say for instance we're looking at abstinence, so we've removed substance from our lives, is that then the education or the emotional component begins. And so we do a lot of work around keeping people present in the moment, and engaging more in active process as opposed to end result. And though setting goals is extremely important, we recognize that, you know, within the 3 hours that we share with them each day, is looking at what did we get in that 3 hours. So when we walked through the door today and we got here and we sat down in the chair, what did I communicate to myself in that process? And if that's the only thing that we look at in the time, if that's the only thing that a young person's able to get to in that 3 hours, then they've experienced success on some level. And then we, you know, attempt to compound on that. And that, you know, we have young people that'll show up for a day or two and then we don't see them again. Or we'll have people that will complete the entire 7 weeks and really want to come back or extend their time with us. So always looking at, in the moment, what can we learn? What can we engage a young person in? What kinds of tools can the young person take away with them as they go back out into the real world, right? So creative expressions, this lighter form of art therapy, is a really great opportunity. We've got a nice little buffer. We're doing something with our hands, and we're able to sit around a table and be with each other in a group setting, but not necessarily have to engage in a way that might be unsafe, right? We're always thinking about, and I'm excited to read your work, Dr. Sari, because I think that you know, we're doing our best to work from a trauma-informed, in a trauma-informed practice kind of way, and recognizing that every single person that comes into our space has experienced trauma in some way. And so finding opportunity to just be with each other in that space is really great. Sometimes I don't even talk, which is amazing for me. We just sit in the space and we'll work together, and you know, we'll have discussions amongst the group members, but oftentimes myself and my colleague won't, you know, we'll simply keep the fire burning, but we're not actually, you know, doing any sort of education pieces. And those are, so that's really exciting that we have an opportunity to do that. We also, again, like I said, it's a very low-barriered environment, and so sometimes we'll have young people that are maybe working on a stabilization process in terms of their mental health, or maybe they haven't even gotten there yet. And so then we've got other folks who are really far along in the recovery process, and they're, you know, ready to do different things. So we're always working and trying to come up with different you know, one way of working with all of these people at the same time. And so a lot of our methods are a little bit creative. And, you know, we just kind of each day kind of, we have a set curriculum, but most of the time we throw that curriculum out and we have to do something completely different. So mm-hmm. it's certainly a really unique environment. And I think the takeaway here today, I guess, is just about recognizing that once we've acknowledged that substance is playing a role in terms of the quality of our lives, is that the next piece is around the emotional recovery and being able to do the work within the present moment. And so always trying to challenge our young people to stay right here and right now, and then the future will inevitably come and the past has inevitably passed. And so what can we do right here in this space? And in that space, obviously, we learn a lot about these young people, but they learn a lot about themselves, and it allows them to also acknowledge other things like mental health challenges that they may be having. And so then we're able to do some referrals for things like that as well. So it's a unique program, and we kind of have to fly by the seat of our pants often. So but we just create a space where it's safe for young people to kind of come in and explore where they're at.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for coming and telling us about Wataree and what you do.
Can I just ask, is that only open to Vancouver residents, or who can come to Wataree?
Whoever can get there, right? I mean, though we are funded through VCH, it's been a very rare occasion where we've turned a young person away. The only part is that if we do have fairly strict policy around people coming that know each other. That's one of the challenges that we do face, is that we often will have referrals from same like houses or support systems, and we can't. It's not necessary. It can take away from the therapeutic element if we've got people that know each other.
And where are you located now? Because I remember in the past you were located on 11.
Right. Yeah, we're now located at between 38th and 39th on Victoria Drive.
Okay.
Yeah, so a couple of buses that swing past there.
Right, yeah.
Okay, great. So we'll move on to our final speaker, and then we can have more time for questions and discussion afterwards. So after seeking help for an eating disorder for 3 years ago, Maya Kostanski is on a mission to promote healthy attitudes towards food and exercise. She understands the struggles of dealing with an eating disorder and wants to use her experiences to help others see that recovery is possible. Maya is an avid mountain biker, hiker, and trail runner, and credits the outdoors for playing a large role in her recovery. She wants to inspire others to get outside and lead healthy and balanced lives. So welcome, Maya.
Thank you. I wasn't really sure what to expect, so I hope this doesn't come off too structured because I have it written down. So my journey is, of course, dealing with an eating disorder, I guess my substance of choice was food, so hopefully you can tie in well. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be quite a personal story, and I'm trying to focus on setbacks a lot, so hopefully that's of value. So just to give a little bit of background on my struggle, I started struggling with food when I was about 13 years old, so dieting, buying diet foods, which led, of course, to a cycle of starving myself, and then consequently binging. I actually remember about being 15 years old and walking into a supplement store and buying these low-calorie, high-protein cheese puffs, which tasted like cardboard. This cycle continued for a few years, and when I was about 17 years old, I started to use exercise as a way to make up for my binging. In fact, I failed my first year of university because I would spend hours upon hours in the gym instead of going to class. About age 22, I'm 26 now, I was binging quite often, and after a particularly devastating weekend, I called the Kelty Crisis Line, searching for help on the internet. And they connected me to resources that put me on the path to recovery. And in fact, it's quite incredible because as I was preparing for the talk today, I went back into my emails and I found about 15 of them back and forth with the eating disorders peer support worker, who's Amy, mm-hmm. And myself. And it was quite surreal reading them because I actually forgot a lot of those difficult times. And in general, emails seem to be so insignificant, but those emails were a lifeline at the time, so I'm really grateful I had them. And I can't pinpoint an exact day that I stopped binging. It was a slow process, as any recovery is. But one day I woke up and it dawned on me I hadn't binged in 4 or 5 months, and it was a really great feeling. So I'm going to share 5 setbacks, and hopefully they're valuable information. The first setback I experienced was people actually downplaying my disorder or telling me I was overreacting without even listening to my story. So whenever I confide in people about my struggles, I'm often met with, but you were never fat growing up, you've always been so active, or you don't have a problem, you're small, right? And I've even heard this from my close family, and it's almost as if I feel they don't believe me. And it hurts because it diminishes the struggle I went through and the hard work I've put in to overcome the disorder. These comments made me question, maybe I really am overreacting, and maybe I never had a problem. But this thinking is harmful. Saying the words, I have an eating disorder, was one of the hardest things I had to do. Therefore, being told by my family that I was overreacting was absolutely devastating. I call this a setback because every time I was faced with denial from others during recovery, I felt as though I didn't deserve the help, or that I was wasting help on myself when there were others with more severe problems than myself. These comments from my loved ones were a huge red flag to me, because it shows that there's a lot of work left to be done on breaking common misconceptions about certain eating disorders. Of course, an individual does not have to be overweight to be a binge eater, and being overweight doesn't automatically make someone a binge eater either. So the truth is, those living with eating disorders all fall on a scale, and the severity of everyone's experience is different, but that does not mean that they're not struggling. My next setback was surviving several relapses, but more importantly, trying to let go of the idea of perfection. My relapses back then all stemmed from a constant pursuit of perfection. Even today, negative thoughts make their way into my mind based on me thinking that I'm not good enough. Most people look at me and consider me to be fit and active, and my Facebook is littered with photos of me hiking and mountain biking. But there were days, and there still are days, where I just don't feel good enough, and I feel the need to look better and achieve this perfect standard. Whereas I don't binge anymore, I still have days where I overeat, and it spurs these thoughts of what's wrong with me. But in reality, I know now there's nothing wrong with me. Perfection is a battle in my mind, fueled by the messages of media and society. And so I'm overcoming this frame of mind in 2 ways, one of which I'll talk about later, which is setting goals outside of fitness. But because I do love weightlifting and outdoor sports, fitness goals are still important for me. The difference now is, instead of centering them around how I look or how much I weigh, they center around things such as being able to lift heavier weights or being able to run for longer. This frame of mind has helps in reevaluating my relationship with food, because in the past I tried to be perfect with my food too, which looking back sounds ridiculous. It's such an unattainable goal. I mean, what is perfect eating anyway? It doesn't exist, yet I had this idea about food, and it was all or nothing. Either I ate the entire fridge, or I ate only fruits and vegetables, but there was no room for error. I was basically not allowing myself to be human. But the minute I changed my fitness goals from appearance to endurance, and took up sports such as mountain biking, which require physical strength, food became fuel and a source of energy. Mentally, this is one of the hardest thoughts to switch. So freeing myself from the confines of perfection is an ongoing solution to the setback. I gave up weighing myself and started to measure how I felt solely on my energy levels. And one of my mantras whenever I overeat now or whenever I get anxious is, you're only human, which really helps. Another setback, which is an interesting one for eating disorders, was a lack of patience while cooking. During my binge eating disorder, I acquired a lot of bad habits revolving food. And one of those habits was eating too much too fast before my brain could register what I was putting in my body. I had to essentially relearn how to cook and how to eat properly, and a resource I constantly referred back to was the idea of intuitive eating, meaning only eating when I was truly hungry and not putting restrictions on what I ate. I always think of a dear friend of mine, because as funny as this sounds, I have always admired his way of cooking. He takes his time to prepare satisfying meals and doesn't eat half his dinner while cooking. He then cleans his dishes before he sits down to eat, and then he would even save some for the next day, which to me was like mind-blowing. This isn't about being perfect. It's about acquiring habits that make people feel good. when I cook and eat in the same way as he does, I simply feel better. During my recovery, I learned that healthy habits should not be obsessive, but should come naturally and not get in the way of living, and I think that's a fine line. Another setback for me during recovery was being able to afford counseling services. When I contacted the Kelty Crisis Line back in 2012, one of the questions they had asked if I was a student, and I had no idea that being a UBC student, I had $300 a year towards counseling services through my student health plan. And that was great, but I quickly used up the money within a few sessions anyways. Counseling is so important to any recovery, so those without a health plan, or I can see it being really tough. More importantly, getting consistent help is really hard. I had really large gaps in seeing counselors, which set back my recovery. That being said, having access to free resources, such as emailing the peer support worker, lessened the impact of the gaps because I was constantly communicating to someone about my struggles. Looking back, this ability to vent to a professional was more helpful than I gave credit to at the time. Almost done. I lost myself during the years of my eating disorder. So the last setback I will talk about was the journey of rediscovering what I wanted out of life and setting goals not based on appearance and clothing size. Now that I am so far into my recovery, I often say that with the amount of mental energy I have spent on an eating disorder, I could have completed a PhD at this point. Looking back on my life, from around the time my eating disorder started, I realized that almost all of my goals were short-term appearance and weight-focused goals. And the reason this starkly stands out for me is while I have some friends who are now doctors, designers, and engineers, and they're well into their careers, and I still feel stuck because those were never a priority for me. And you mentioned goals a bit as well, and it is a fine line of thinking too far ahead and living in the moment. I even found old journal entries where my goals are always the same. Lose 5 pounds by next Friday, get down to 120 pounds, only eat fruits and vegetables. So I started thinking about shifting my energy away from food and onto other goals, such as traveling and career and life goals. I remember in one of the emails with the peer support worker, she said that when she took the focus off food and placed it on her life goals, food all of a sudden was boring to her. I still experience daily setbacks where I find myself focusing on the size of my stomach or how I feel, but I've come to accept that I probably will never fully erase these thoughts, but the difference after recovery is that these thoughts are fleeting and don't hold any weight anymore. My solution to these setbacks is immersing myself in things I love to do that focus on personal growth and life goals. And also on that note, I'm pleased to see a lot more female role models in society, and especially in my local community, being celebrated for their educational, athletic, and entrepreneurial achievements. And I think modeling is really key for youth. So that concludes my talk, and thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Maya. That was great. So now we have an opportunity for questions and discussions. So I'm just going to take us off lecture mode. So those of you that are on the phone, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, just give me one sec here.
Conference is no longer in lecture mode.
So for those of you that are on the phone, does anyone have any questions or comments for our speakers? Okay, it doesn't seem like it, but we can come back to the phone. Okay, so what about in the room? Are there questions here?
I'm interested about, for example, working on youth. One thing about, the religious level or the spiritual level on the youth, is it helpful to them, or is it not yet the right time to be one of the support for them, or what is the time is good for them to be, get involved in some spiritual or religious or whatever level on their recovery?
I think, like, in terms of our programming, it's certainly an element, like when we're doing a care plan, which is sort of setting their goals and figuring out the different areas of their lives that have been impacted, and then the areas of their lives that they would like to see improvement in. And one of the areas is, we coin it as spiritual, and how a young person identifies to spiritual will depend, right? So it can be some youth will identify it as a cultural practice. Some will look at it as a spirituality, as a, you know, very general theme, and others will connect to in their childhood perhaps what of their religious upbringing has mm-hmm. been up to that point. And certainly in many cases we either encourage that reconnection to those things, or if that's something that they may wish to explore in the future, then we certainly can resource to do that. Sometimes it's even, if they're abstinence-based, is looking to go to 12-step. 12-step might be their very first introduction to anything that's spiritual in content, simply, and, you know, it's simply because it looks at a creator or at God as a key component of support, right? So, again, it's just about, like, exploring from where they're at, what's comfortable for them. But, I mean, absolutely, right, is that spiritual practices, I mean, there's literature that, you know, talks about how important that connection to something larger than ourselves and brings us back to ourselves. So, yeah, we do our best within. Yeah.
What about in your program? Does that play out?
I think part of when we do our trying to understand and create a treatment plan, then if there is a more spiritual component to it, that's always something that we would help them explore. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't put any, you know, pressure either way for people. One of the comments I wanted to make was that after listening to you speak, I was thinking, you know, that there are so many similarities. You know, I know it's not necessarily talking about substance use, but there's a lot of similarities with the things that you're talking about in your setbacks. There's a few differences, right, that when people are struggling with substance use run into. But, you know, I was one of the things you're talking about is kind of downplaying things. And I was thinking, you know, this time of year is a really challenging time for a lot of people who have struggle with substances, because this is such a time around celebration and New Year's Eve and giving gifts of alcohol or giving gifts of things. And so that I can see is also a challenge when you're when you do have an area that you're struggling with, but then around you everywhere there's these triggers, and we talk about kind of the people, the places, the things that are constant triggers. And one of the struggles I see a lot of young people tell me about is when they are trying to make major changes in their life, sometimes they end up isolating themselves from they can't see those friends anymore, they can't go to those places anymore, and then they're alone in this. And so on the one hand it's helping, and on the other hand it's not, and so it gets really complicated. And and then adding into that is that difficulty of finding out where you can go to get help, because it isn't clear. We don't have a great, you know, system that says, oh, you just have to go to this one website or go to call this one number, and it all kind of opens up and you'll be able to find what you need. Mm-hmm. It's a real struggle, and I know that on many levels of leadership and government, where it's recognized that this is a problem, that we can't easily navigate this system. So not just for substance use, but for all mental health and all just services for young people. Then the other part that came up with me is this idea of relapses, because we do see this idea that if I relapse, maybe that's a failure, and we need to kind of change that understanding of a relapse as ability to learn more about yourself, mm-hmm. and take that as a starting place to move forward. And kind of as you're saying, living in the moment, the past is the past. Where do we go from here in the moment, and then how do you change tomorrow? Not maybe a year from now, but kind of keeping it more in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I saw a lot of overlap with that as well. Some of the things I think that is a little bit different is when you have an eating disorder, it's not like you can just become abstinent from food, right? Where if you have a problem with cocaine or heroin, you can just not use those again, right? And some of the things I think we struggle with is the brain changes that can come with losing control over a substance, because the cravings can be triggered, and it can be a very much a biological drive that's taking you to using a substance. And also when that substance has been a big part of triggering those parts of the brain for novelty and for for pleasure, that when people stop using, suddenly things are really dull and boring. And then, of course, they're isolating, and they might not be able to find the support they need, and then all of that is high risk for setbacks. So it's great that we have some things that you can go to, like go every day, meet some people, be out of your home, sitting with others, even if it's sitting in, you know, painting or doing clay, it's being together and not being isolated in this. Yeah, and then I guess part of the journey of discovery, as you're saying, is kind of rediscovering yourself. And a lot of the things we hear from people that have had a kind of a longer term involvement with substances is that during those, you know, teenage years when they were off using substances, what they weren't doing was being in school and being with their friends and doing sports. So it's like they've had a time out for a couple of years, and now they're coming back going, you know, all of my group of friends have kind of moved on, and I have to kind of go back and do a little bit of that work that I missed. And that sometimes it's a hard thing to kind of realize that, you know, like some skills, just even about managing distress, or sometimes it's like things that they just haven't learned, you know. I've had people say, I'm not really sure how to, you know, pay my bills, or I'm not really sure how to get the bank account, and all those things, which I think gets taught in some high school stuff. But if you're not in high school, you kind of miss out on that. And then once you pass the age of high school, you just don't get the opportunities anymore. So thank you. I mean, I like to see that overlap is really interesting.
Thanks, Dr. Sari. Just wanted to give an opportunity for people over the phone again, if you have any questions or comments to make for our speakers.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question for Maya.
Yes.
My daughter is 14 years old, and she's being discharged today from the day program at the Eating Disorder Clinic at BC Children's Hospital. We've been here since September, and she's doing very well. Listening to you talk about the support, you know, from friends that you didn't really feel like you had with, you know, them not really taking it seriously, that's going to be a big hurdle for our daughter. And I'm just wondering, for you, because you seem to be well in your recovery, what's your best advice can you give to help combat that? Because when she goes back, she has a lot of healthy, positive thinking, but a lot of her friends are, you know, still in a depressive mode, or they're self-harming, or some are doing drugs, and it's going to be hard for her not to get drawn into that, and have her eating disorder start to take over again.
Right. In terms of people, a lot of it stemmed, I think, from my family not understanding the disorder, and also I felt like they didn't want to admit I had a problem, because that would require them blaming themselves. It's not my mom or my dad's fault, but just loved ones, they tend to do that. So I think my mom comes from a place of wanting to protect herself from thinking that she did anything quote-unquote wrong. It was a struggle, in that even now when I talk about my eating disorder, I feel quite alone and vulnerable when I talk about it. So it can be hard bringing it up to friends and saying it openly, but if she's comfortable telling it to friends, she's known for a long time, the more and more she says it and becomes comfortable with the fact that this happened, but I'm moving past it, is actually really good progress versus keeping it in. It has to be with friends that she really trusts, and with loved ones that she trusts. The more you talk about it, it's so difficult in the moment, but you actually feel a weight lifted off after. I hope that kind of helps.
Yeah, it does. And I know she's ready to talk to some of her friends about it, which is good, because when she does go back and she reintegrates into school, it'll be good for her. I think just having the strength just not to get caught up in the negativity, I suppose, is just for us to be there to support her with that.
Right, which is something you can do at home by setting up like a very supportive environment. So at least when
right.
she comes home, she always has that.
Right.
Yeah. It's really hard to
Thank
control
you.
Others, though, like her friends. And so for me, it was, I've always had really close friends, and but it was finding activities and sports that were really positive for me that helped me stay positive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your question. Anyone else on the phone that might have a question or comment for our speakers? Okay, and how about in the room? Any other questions or comments?
Can I add to that?
Sure, go ahead. Yeah, of course.
Just in terms of prepping her to go back to reintegrate kind of into that environment, I mean, it's not part of the emotional side of recovering, too, we learn more in overcoming the challenges that we're going to face. Like, that's sort of the next stage, right? So maybe even doing some family discussions around possible, getting her to brainstorm some of the possible situations that might come up and how she might address them so that she has some ideas that are quick at hand. And it might help you too, right, to be able to do some of the brainstorming with her and maybe share some situations that you think might come up. And then as a family, like coming together and collaborating on, hey, what are some of the ways that you know, we might be able to overcome this, or when you're in that situation, how might you be able to overcome? Because I think what Maya was saying is that open and honest approach is always the big strengthening piece. And then us being ready too, that right, life's going to happen. And so when we're in the midst of this life, then what can we do in those situations?
Right.
Yeah.
Right, thank you.
Thanks. I have a question. I guess in terms of doing sort of more direct support work, and responding to clients that face setbacks, how do you balance sort of like unpacking whatever that incident might have been, especially around like problematic substance use or self-harm, versus like you're saying, focusing on the present and like how to move forward from that?
I think recognizing the wisdom that comes from those experiences, right? Like our past is important. It's we like to use the metaphor of the car. So we're in the driver's seat and we're driving, and we've got we need a couple of things in order to drive safely. We need to have a clear windshield so that we can see ahead of us and where it is that we want to go. But we also need to be able to take stock of, you know, that our hands are on the steering wheel at the 10 and the 2, and that where's the left and right turn signal, and where's our shifter, and can we feel our feet safely planted on the gas and on the brake, you know, and in all of the situation within the car, like, do we feel comfortable, confident? And then there's the third part, which is we need the rearview mirror, and the rearview mirror is super important because we need to be able to glance into it occasionally so that we can recognize where it is that we're coming from. But if we drove with our eyes only in the rearview mirror, then what's going to happen? We're going to crash, right? So it's that balance of, like, I need to be here and present so that I can drive this car, but I also need to be having a little bit of, you know, clarity around what's in front of me and make sure those windshield wipers are working so that I can get there. But and also, can I take a look at the past or what's behind me, and how is that going to impact me right here, right now, and potentially what might come up kind of in that. So I like to use metaphors because the rest of it gets too complicated sometimes when working with people, but just working from that, the capacity building and the wisdom space of like, yeah, you know what, all of this stuff has happened. And so, and honoring that, you know, are there ways that we can do that together or whatever? And then right here and right now, how can we ground ourselves in this space here so that we can get to where we ultimately want to kind of get to. Does that make sense?
I think so. I guess I'm thinking just sort of maybe like in a specific example, especially when you don't have necessarily very consistent contact with the youth, but if somebody comes in and they've just had an incident like the night before that they're feeling upset about related to like some goals they have with themselves around substance use or self-harm, So say you can anticipate I might have half an hour of contact with this person, mm-hmm. and then who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like the tendency can be to sort of get stuck in like unpacking what happened with the incident and how to sort of like, should you try and refocus right away on, like, how are you feeling now, and then maybe, like, look back, like, maybe start with that and then sort of...
What I do, so, for example, if it is, like, a substance use goal, because I think depending on what the goal is and the situation that happened is gonna, like, this can't be, like, a blanket approach, but with... For people that, say, have relapsed in their substance use, what I usually talk about is what were the triggers? So what was going on for you? Was it an emotion? Were you feeling, like, they may say, well, you know what, I was really bored. And then it's like, okay, well, so that this is what we know. Boredom's a big trigger. So now we're going to have to work on is what are some healthy ways that you can, like, what healthy things can you do to deal with your boredom? And then kind of just figuring out, okay, what's that trigger? And then what skills would work for you for next time? So kind of using these experiences as learning opportunities.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what I usually do. And kind
so
of figure
focusing
out
the discussion on the triggers and then kind of moving forward.
Yeah, but it would be probably different for any different situation.
Yeah. And it's not always easy because if you have a time pressure, you have to, that's kind of that art of it, to kind of be able to manage the time and say, okay, I've got this much time, where can we focus, but still not leave you feeling upset when you walk out the door, because we don't want that, right? We don't want to just unpack it all and then say, okay, bye, and, you know, good luck with that. That's part of, you know, what we need to do in that skill is being able to focus, but also move it somewhere that a person still feels safe. And sometimes you don't have half, you know, you have half an hour, and you realize, you know what, this isn't possible. I need to spend more time, and that's where we become patient-centered and say, you know what, luckily a lot of us work in teams, and we can say, you know, I do have something, another appointment, but could somebody else kind of come in there and help me out, because this is an important thing and I can't leave it, so...
I can add to that from an eating disorder point of view. The triggers is really important for pinpointing what the trigger was. But I remember emails from Amy, because I was looking through them last night. There was one where I emailed her at like midnight saying I had a really big binge tonight. The next morning she wrote me back and she actually said, don't give it too much thought with eating disorders, especially binge eating. Just keep on living normally, because if I thought about it too much, I would obsess right away. So it's definitely dependent on the substance.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Any other comments or questions from anyone?
I have a question. My role is primarily working with parents of children and adolescents, so they might have like eating disorders or mental health issues or substance use issues. So I'm just curious as to all of your thoughts on the role of parents and, you know, the most important things you think that they can do for their kids, besides obviously seeking support for their kids, but what else do you think is the most important?
Staying.
Sorry? I was just going to say, as parents, staying connected to their child, so whether that is having their favorite food in the house or just keeping conversations positive and just trying to avoid negative conversations, because you don't want to push your daughter or son away.
Right.
You want to keep them in.
Yeah.
Keep them to stay connected.
Okay.
Yeah, be supportive. Listen, respect. Yeah. Are huge ones.
I think for parents it's also being open as well. Sometimes a youth comes in as the identified patient. And the openness that we need is for us to kind of take a bigger picture.
Yeah.
And say, now that person doesn't exist alone. There's friends, there's school, there may be work, there's family. We kind of have to take a bigger, broader view. And I think it's very important for parents to be a part of this.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we say that this is a youth program, but this is really a family program, right? And I know we kind of walk this fine line between, you know, how much can we divulge, the confidentiality and all that. Ideally, we would all be open and just say, you know, we need to talk together.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's not safe for people at the beginning, and that's where we're trying to get to, is a place where they feel comfortable being able to talk to their parent in the room and be open with them, and the parent can do the same back, and they don't have to worry about, I don't want to bring this up or that up. right? I mean, we know that those conversations sometimes happen. I think to add to what Jennifer was saying is kind of picking your moments too, right? Mm-hmm. And having that awareness of when's the right time to kind of bring up something. Mm-hmm. And it might not be when they're already, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, scared, intoxicated. Those are not the best times. So there's also that just openness and awareness for the families to kind of check in with themselves and how they're feeling and be aware of what's going on with their youth at the time.
Okay, thank you. And the other piece I would just add is that it's obviously really important that the parents have supports themselves and that they're accessing all of those pieces too, because recovery and from anything, it's a family process. It's not ever just the young person all by themselves. And we deal with parents calling, you know, and we're a youth-focused program. But there's sort of triaging that happens with the parents too, because they love so hard, and they feel really isolated in that process, I think. So including family support.
Mm-hmm. Just to add a comment to that from the parent's perspective, with my daughter's eating disorder, that was one thing that she felt very secure with once we learned to not react to something that was happening with our own anxiety or our own fear, but listen and provide her, you know, whatever guidance and consoling that we could, so that she started to feel more safe coming to us, that she didn't have to worry about letting us know about anything, because we were going to be there for her. We were going to be her comfort. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a huge, huge thing that helped her as far as starting to become open with us.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, well, I think that's pretty much it. So thanks to everyone on the phone. Thank you so much to our speakers. And happy holidays, everyone. See you next year.